Fifth or fourth? Fifth. Okay. Praise the Lord. Have you forgotten all the Greek you knew? Or?
My Greek. Greek to me.
Let's see. We've got Greg. Is there anybody else here that is coming in that wasn't in this particular class last semester? I think we've got Keith Slover on the list there, and Rob Lilly too, I think. Well, I guess they're not here yet, but I'll talk with him and get him phased in here. Shouldn't be any problem. I've already talked to Greg, and he'll be able to smoothly make the adjustment, hopefully, here. We'll see. I want to give you, first of all, a little bit of an idea of what Greek 2 will be about, some basic format of what we're going to do here in Greek 2. And first and foremost is review. So we'll be spending the first couple of weeks at least just going through the textbook again briefly, and taking the time that we need to take to get us back in shape, and not belaboring things that everybody seems to be, you know, remembering real well. So we'll go through, you know, from the chapter one on just briefly, and we'll start that today, and we'll be going on with that for at least probably the next couple weeks. And then after that, we'll go ahead and finish Getchus. We left off around chapter 41, so we'll finish the last 9 or 10 chapters of that, so we'll have the book finished, and those will go relatively quickly. And then we'll be launching into some new areas. First, we'll be doing a lot of refinement, or I shouldn't say refinement, but adding a lot of fine points of grammar and finer details of grammar. We'll be using Dana and Manti. If you don't have a copy of that, you may want to procure one from the library. Do they have any in stock?
Yeah, they're going fast.
Okay. Yeah, there's some on the back here too. So if you ever get stuck, you know, on the back shelf, we'll be able to pull one down and you can use that. But it's a good reference book to have. So if you don't have a copy of it yet, I would recommend it. And so we'll be taking from time to time and going through certain sections of that, especially things on the article, getting a lot more detail on a lot of things we've already had, but getting more detail. Studying the prepositions, for example, in greater detail than we were able to before, and things like that. We'll also be drawing from other sources, from Robertson and from, you know, a lot of the other grammars, and we'll be looking at Granville-Sharp's rule and some things of this nature. Then we'll be spending some. Now, the next things I'm going to say won't necessarily come in this order, but we'll also be taking a look at diagramming Greek sentences. And we're not going to spend an awful long time on that, but I want to spend enough time on it just because, not because diagramming itself is all that important, but because it really helps to solidify and gel the understanding of Greek grammar that you have. Greek's a very conceptual language. It's very much aligns itself with this kind of analysis. Hebrew doesn't, it's much more difficult to do diagramming Hebrew. We won't even bother to do that for the Hebrew students. But Greek lends itself very well to that kind of an analysis. So we'll set up a system and we'll do some diagramming. And this will be a help for you later on doing grammatical analysis. Even though you may not actually write a diagram out for a Bible study or something, in some cases you may, but being able to do that will enable you to begin to look at that thing properly and be able to piece it together the way it should be and not make some mistakes. So we want to spend some time with that. Then the bulk of the class is going to be involving translating the New Testament, and we'll be doing that in the class. Now, we're not going to sit down and translate the entire New Testament, but I want to do something a little different than most Greek classes do. Most of the time, you never hardly get out of the Gospel of John, and because John's the simplest Greek in the New Testament. We're going to spend some time in the Gospel of John. That's where we'll begin, but I don't want to turn you loose from this class, never having looked at Hebrews, for example, or some of these other areas of Scripture where the Greek is a lot more difficult. So I want you to get exposure to all of these portions of Scripture. So we'll be going through the New Testament. We'll take some in Pauline epistles. We'll be taking some time in the book of Hebrews and the book of Revelation and so forth, and getting samplings of the Greek throughout the entire New Testament, so we've got a good grasp of what's going on. Now, when we get to that point, you'll want to have UBS. If you don't have a UBS Greek text, be sure you get one. And be sure it's UBS, not the interlinear. No interlinears allowed for your purposes. I'll have all kinds of references up here, you know, to consult when we run into, you know, words, a new vocabulary, something like that. And I'll have a parsing guide and so forth, so we'll have a quick reference to nail down anything we need to. But for your benefit only, I'm asking you just to use the UBS, because it's going to force you to be instead of running down to the English, to be trying to figure it out, and this will help you immensely. So we'll be doing that in class. We'll be going around the class and so forth. You all have opportunities to work on this, and we'll be doing a lot of discussion as we go. It's not going to just be, you know, translating and that's it. We're going to be, as we translate it, we're going to be asking ourselves questions as to why this, why that, looking at the various possibilities and so forth. So that's the cream of the class, I think. That's where you really begin to get the benefits of it, and it's kind of a corporate effort at really seeing and experiencing what the Greek class, what good the Greek, all this work you've done last year has, and the fruits that are going to be accruing from that. And we'll be having some quizzes on translation also. Much of your testing in the second year, at least after we get through Getchus, won't be like it was last year. It won't be cramming paradigms into your head and trying to, you know, write them back out, that type of thing. It won't be so much rote memory work. What it'll be is you'll be translating. In other words, I will warn you ahead of time what sections of Scripture you'll be responsible for. And then when the test comes, I'll just say, open UBS, and you know, I'll tell you what sections, and you'll have to translate. And so, of course, you can prepare for that, you know, and I'll give you a lot more sections to look at than will actually be on the test. But you'll find it's not that difficult of a thing. Sometimes if you don't even know the Scripture, I'm going to try to find some things that you don't know so well, you know. Otherwise, you can just translate it from remembering what it says in English, but remembering what verse it is, you know. John 3:16, you know. Yeah, right. It all comes out in King James. And you'll be in real trouble when the King James translated it wrong. Okay, so that's going to be the bulk of the class once we get to that point. What we'll do is we'll probably be doing that as our kind of a running theme, and then we'll be adding some of these other things in as we go, and taking a break here for a week to do this and that type of thing. And then in the second semester, we won't do this the first semester, but in the second semester, I don't want to scare you off in the second semester here, but what I'm going to do is have each of you do a short research assignment on some grammatical issue. And there are many grammatical issues to do them on. In the past, we've done them on prepositions and the meaning of prepositions, but I think I'm going to open it up a little bit more, because there's other issues some of you may want to deal with. So during the course of this semester, you can be thinking about what you might like to do. What I'm looking for example, is on the preposition assignment that we've done in the past. What we did is we divided up the Greek prepositions into groups, and each student took a group of prepositions, and they did an inductive study on it by going to the Scriptures themselves. Instead of looking at what all the books said they mean, what they did is look through every instance in the New Testament where that preposition was used, and looked for common patterns of meaning, and began to see for themselves, you know, what these things mean. And after all, that's what all the lexicographers did originally anyway. And so I want to give you some experience in doing this kind of thing, because it'll be of great value to you later on when it comes time to question, in some cases, what some of the Greek scholars have said, because there are theological implications that get cranked in to the way that even the grammar books analyze something. So some of you may want to take some of those prepositions, even though many of them have been done in the past, but it's good to keep getting more and more research on these things. Also, things like the uses of tenses, and the aspects and so forth, aorist participles, you know, things like this somebody can do. They've done a real good job of this in the Tongues on Trial book. The section that they've done on that is really excellent on the aorist participles and so forth, and use of the aorist. Well, I guess the one I was looking at is John 20:22, the aorist imperative. But that kind of thing, there's lots of those little details that theological implications have been cranked into some of the things you read in the books, and those would be real excellent to do. So what I'd like to do with those is have them done in a real neat fashion, like the grad students are doing their thesis, mini-thesis work and this type of thing, and we'll have them all copied and made available and put a copy on reference in the library. So that's what we're looking toward for the second semester. And I don't intend this to be a gigantic thing. I'd rather that you take a very specific issue and do a good job on it so that you really learn how to approach something like this, and we'll be giving you a lot of help, and we'll take some time in class to discuss it and so forth. That I think it'll really be a blessing to you, and it'll be something that that personal experience will stick with you and really help you in the future when it comes time you're a pastor someplace and issues come up and somebody's argued about, you know, the Greek tense here or something like that. You'll be able to really know how to attack something like that and get it figured out. And we don't have our, you know, computer programs on being able to find all the various forms in the New Testament and so forth yet. Maybe someday somebody will come up with that. Yeah, Dale?
Text.
Okay. Good. That's one step.
Into it, but it's supposed to be able to go from the English to the Greek and type where that Greek word is used in the New Testament.
Great. Good. We're making progress, and we're just what we're looking for is a program that will be able to, you know, if you crank in, for example, an aorist participle, it'll give you all the aorist participles in the New Testament or something like that. You know, that'd be a real job. But
it's not the one that Jim said they had, but
he's been working on it. He's been doing some research on it. Yeah.
Matter of fact,
we're going to need a bigger computer.
Be able to do it. Uh-huh. It would require like a mainframe, though, instead of.
I think so.
He'd have access to a pretty huge computer.
Yeah.
Exactly on the same computer system as the one that got on the TV, be able to cross wire straight across my telephone.
We'll see.
Yeah.
I'm really, you know, I think it would really be useful someday if we had the ability to do that. We could do kinds of analyses that probably have never been done before. So that's what we're looking toward. So that's about the size of it as far as the actual things we're going to be doing. And we'll be getting into it real soon here after we get through the review and finish Getch's book up. Okay, one more little note here before we get started with review. Some of you remember Mike Beaton was doing some research on getting a copy made of that big parsing guide or that big paradigm, color-coded paradigm on the Greek verbs and so forth in the library. And what we wanted to do was get a copy made that preserved the color coding. And he said he's talked to a number of printing places and so forth, and he can get it done. They need to. It's 11 by 17 is the largest sheets they can do, so they need two passes with it in order to get the whole thing. So you'd have to, you know, get two sheets and tape them together or something. But it's not cheap. And if only one person gets it, it's $7.50 each for a sheet, so that'd be about $15 for the whole chart. If five or more people want it, then it reduces to $5 a sheet, so it'd be $10 total. And if 25 plus do it, then you're down to $2.50 each. So what I'd like to do here is just to see if there's enough interest. I don't think we'd get enough as many for 25, but we might get over five. If we get over five, then it'll be $10 each. How many of you would be willing to shell out $10 for that chart? You may want to take some time, take a look at it again to find out. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Okay, we've got at least 8. Okay, I'll tell Mike we can probably do it, and then we'll come back to you and get an exact number. Some of you may want to take a look at the chart in the library there. It's still in the grad library, I think. It's not somebody's disposed of it or something. I hope not. But it's out of print, so we couldn't get any copies anymore, you know, from the original printer. Okay, good. Well, we'll see what we can do on that. Okay, does anybody have any questions or difficulties? I mentioned here with Rob, you took the Greek class last time I taught it, didn't you? Greek 1?
Way ago.
Way long ago. So, right. Right. So I mentioned to Greg here, just you know, if you want to do some, we're going to do some review the first couple of weeks, and that may, you know, get you back on board. And if not, you may just want to go through and redo some of your exercises in Getch's and so forth. Just kind of brush yourself up, and if you have any problems, just see me about it. We'll see. Make sure we make a smooth transition here. Yeah, Dan?
Do you know what paper that would be on?
No, he didn't say anything about that. That's a good question, because if it was a little bit heavier weight paper, it would be a lot better. I'll ask them about that and see what they can do. I don't know if these printing methods would allow them to use a heavier weight paper or not. We'll check on that. Yeah, right. Right, with gold gilded edges and everything, you know. Okay. Anybody else with a question or anything before we get started here? Okay, well, let's pull out our trusty Getches here and see what we can do. Now, most of you are aware of the fact that Getches isn't necessarily the best, the only Greek grammar book that you can use. And if you would like, once we're through with Getches, it might be good for you if you have Machen or you have some other, you know, basic Greek grammar to go through that and see the differences and so forth. Generally, the differences are usually in terms of how they organize the information and in what order they present things and so forth. You get pretty much the same information in most of the books, but it's arranged differently. And Getches has got his real strong points and he's got his weak points, and just about all the books do. So it probably would be wise for you just to look at it from another perspective, you know, and compare them if you have the opportunity. Now, first chapter, of course, dealt with the Greek alphabet, and I don't know if we need to do anything more with that. Hopefully you can remember the Greek alphabet, or at least remember how to form the letters. If you're having any trouble with that, you might just go through and do a little bit of a writing exercise and make sure that it all comes back. Well, I thought we might have, you know, some non-graded quizzes or something like that. Just, you know, I might spring some things on you from, you know, time to time in the next few days, just to jog your memory. It wouldn't be turned in, but just, you know, let you know where your weak points are, real quick. So we'll see. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah, I think you'll find that it'll come back. You know, it's you probably got a little bit of you know a lot of rust in the gears there, but get the machinery oiled up and get it going again. You'll find it's not that difficult. At least the first part. You know, once we get up into the tenses and so forth again, and the verb forms, you'll probably find we'll have to slow down quite a bit in our review. This transliteration, I don't know if I even want to review that because I don't particularly like transliteration anyway. So. And this is just one system. There are variations on this. I don't know if Publications has adopted a standard for this, for the transliteration, if it's the same as this or not. Do you happen to know, Mark? Or are you trying to switch to putting the Greek in to everything that you're printing now?
I think it probably follows this fairly closely.
Yeah. If it's different, it's probably only in a very minor. I can't think of anything that would be different. Sometimes there's variations on whether you use upsilon, you know, use a Y or a U for upsilon, depending in the various situations. Of course, you're in footnote 3 here, Greek upsilon is rendered by U in combinations in the diphthongs, in other words, and otherwise by Y. And I've seen that, but I've also seen it just using U all the time. So that may be one of the major variations. Does anybody have any questions on that, on the transliteration? It's a problem. Okay, pronunciation. We talked last time when we first went through this about the fact that pronunciation is somewhat artificial. In other words, we don't know what the pronunciation of the Koine Greek was for sure. And so the pronunciation that's been adopted is kind of what they term a scholar's pronunciation of Greek. You know, in other words, we're resurrecting a dead language, in effect. Even though modern Greek is spoken, it's pronounced considerably different. And if we adopted modern Greek pronunciation, it would be really difficult for you to make distinctions, since many of the diphthongs and vowels all come out sounding the same. And so they've rather chosen, since this kind of Greek that you're learning isn't for speaking, it's for trying to translate the New Testament, a somewhat artificial pronunciation that tries to make a distinction between the various vowel sounds especially. And you always come a little bit short of that, and so you have to make some decisions as to which way you're going to go. So you will find that people that have learned Greek from a different textbook or in a different college or something like that may pronounce things slightly different. So I just want to reiterate the fact that I don't know, Greg, when you your Greek background, we might even check with you and see how your pronunciation, how you learned it. But the major problems, I think, the major variations are in the pronunciation of omicron, for example. And we're pronouncing it with an O sound, short O sound. Many pronounce it ah, And I don't know what you learned, Greg. Do you? Did you remember?
I remember we were kind of sloppy on this.
Mm-hmm.
I think people just poke it like they look to them.
Okay, yeah. That's sometimes what happens, too. And yeah. So we would say logos, and some would say logos. And you have to make a decision, you know, see, because, in fact, the book here says to pronounce it ah, but I learned it o, and I found that to me, it was easier to get confused between the omicron and the alpha. If you went ah for, you know, omicron and then ah for alpha, you run into a problem there. Otherwise, and the other problem, of course, is between omicron and omega. And so you kind of have to make a choice. And if you make the omega sound, just stretch it out a little bit longer. And that's apparently from archaeology and from linguistic studies and so forth, they feel that the Koine probably did pronounce the omicron as an O sound from the research I was able to do. So I had to make a decision, and that's the way I went. But I certainly wouldn't be upset if you pronounced it logos and so forth. But it's good to kind of keep a standard among us if we can, and you're going to find people pronouncing it differently. So just be aware of that, and don't tell them, well, you don't know Greek because you pronounce it ah. You know, that would betray an ignorance of the situation on your part. So be careful about that. Okay. The other one was, of course, the epsilon iota, that diphthong. The pronunciation we learned was A, pronouncing it A like in the word weight, epsilon iota. And that confuses you with eta. But if you pronounce it I, then you get confused with alpha iota. So, you know, you're kind of stuck in between. And we've chosen to go ahead and go with the book on this one. Okay. Other than that, everything's pretty straightforward to what the book has said, and it's pretty logical to what you would expect from an English standpoint anyway. Was there anything else anybody had a problem with as far as these pronunciations? Now, we have the improper diphthongs here, just to maybe remind you of what they are. We have what's called an iota subscript, and that will occur on alphas, etas, or omegas. And as you've already seen now, these occur especially in the use of the dative. Dative case forms commonly have this iota subscript. We'll also see it a little bit later when we get into the subjunctive. Subjunctive verb forms often have iota subscripts. And it's kind of nice because it helps you identify them real quick at a quick glance. But these are called improper diphthongs, and the pronunciation that we're using is no different with the iota subscript than without it. So we're just pronouncing it, you know, an alpha with the iota subscript, just pronounced like an alpha and so forth. And it makes a difference in the written language, but not in the spoken language, at least the way we're pronouncing it. And then he makes notes here with regard to when you have a word capitalized, if you have a word that begins with a letter that has an iota subscript, which isn't too common, if it's capitalized, letter is capitalized, but the iota is brought up on the line and made a full iota. So you have to kind of be watching for that, because sometimes you'll see a word and you won't recognize it. Where'd that come from, you know? And it won't happen very often, but be aware that that may be what's happened. And if you ever look at unsealed manuscripts, where they're all capitals, there aren't any iota subscripts. They're all right up on the line and they're capitals. And so that's something you need to be aware of, too, if you're ever looking at some of those manuscripts. Okay, consonants, there isn't much, I think, to say about that. As far as the pronunciation, that's all pretty straightforward. You can just review that on your own if you'd like. But combinations of consonants, don't forget that when a gamma is followed by another gamma or by kappa, xi, or phi, it's pronounced like an N, in effect. So you get combinations like NG for in the word finger for two gammas. Gamma kappa is NK as in thinker. Gamma xi is NX as in links. And gamma phi is pronounced like an NG and sing followed by the CH in German ich. So you get kind of a tongue twister unless you've actually got it in a word, which he didn't give us an example of here. Okay. Splankna is one word that has that combination. So. All right, breathings, smooth breathing, rough breathing. Don't forget the breathing marks. Anything that begins with a vowel has got to have a breathing mark of one kind or another. And, of course, the smooth breathing is no pronunciation. The rough breathing, you get an H type of sound. That's the only place you get an H sound in Greek is with the breathing mark. And then the peculiarity for the letter rho, when it begins, the word always has a rough breathing mark. And the transliteration for it is RH rather than HR, like you might expect. And of course, the transliteration of a normal rough breathing mark is usually with an H too. Accents. This section just tells you basically what they are. You'll find three different types of accents: the acute, the grave, and the circumflex. And basically, they apparently originally indicated differences in musical pitch or musical tone or something that we're not able to reproduce now. So for our purposes, they just amount to a stress of the syllable, just like an accent mark in the dictionary in English would be doing. The rules for accents, we may want to take a quick look back at that appendix here, because that's probably something that has grown quite dull. Back on page 319 in that area, let's see. We have the appendix on the Greek accent rules, and maybe I'll just run through it real quick. Like I said, we're not putting a great deal of emphasis on this, so and as far as grading is concerned, you're not being tested on the accents, but it might be good just to run through this real quick again. We find first on page 317, section 390 there talks about vowel length. And for the purposes of accentuation, you need to classify vowels as short or long because it makes a difference as far as how those rules apply. And so they've broken it down. Epsilon and omicron are always short. Eta and omega are always long. And alpha, iota, and upsilon are sometimes short, sometimes long. Okay, and then the diphthongs are always long, except for final omicron, iota, and alpha, iota, when they're final, when they're the last things in the sentence. And they'll be treated short in all forms other than the optative mood. The optative mood is kind of a separate category. In the optative mood, we'll see omicron and iota combinations and not call them short. So we'll kind of save that exception. Fortunately, the optative forms are very rare. You won't see them very often in the New Testament at all. And we won't spend a lot of time trying to wrestle with them because it's not worth it. The syllables. Basically, in Greek, word has as many syllables as it has vowels and diphthongs. So a vowel or diphthong constitutes a syllable. And the breakup of the syllables, they give you some information down at the bottom on this footnote as to how to break up the syllables. It's not all that important, really, as far as we're concerned. As long as you recognize that each vowel or diphthong constitutes a syllable, you'll be able to apply the accent rules without knowing exactly how to split the consonants and so forth. But if you're interested in that kind of thing, there it is down there. Designations of the syllables, remember these terms, the ultima, which is the last syllable, the penult, and the antepenult. So we've got names for the last three syllables. Why no names for any of the other syllables in a word? They're not accented. So as far as accent rules are concerned, we don't worry about if a word's got seven syllables, the first four syllables would never be accented anyway, so there's no reason to put any label on them. So it's just the last three syllables of a Greek word are the only three that can take an accent, and so those are the only three that ever get named. So the ultima, the penult, and the antepenult. Now, general rules of accent. Number one, a word may be accented only on one of its last three syllables, as we just said. B, no word may have more than one accent unless it's followed by an enclitic. And there's a whole section of rules on how enclitics work and so forth. I think you're already familiar with this to some extent, but we'll get some more review on that as we get to that point. That's the only time where you have a word that have more than one accent. In other words, if you get an enclitic that doesn't take an accent itself, sometimes it'll cause the word preceding it, so forth, to get two accents. Then the second rule, part A, the acute accent may stand only on one of the last three syllables of a word. So the acute can go on any of the last three. The circumflex may stand on only one of the last two syllables of a word. And thirdly, the grave accent may only stand on the last syllable of a word. Okay, so there's some restrictions there. These are just restrictions now. They're not telling you how to predict what the accent will be. They're just telling you what it can't be, what it can't be. And third rule, the acute accent may stand on either a long or a short syllable. B, the circumflex may stand only on a long syllable. And the grave accent may stand on either a long or short syllable. So we have some more restrictions. Circumflex, the main thing to remember is the circumflex can only be on a long syllable. Then, fourth rule, these are the more complicated ones. If the ultima is short, in other words, the last syllable is short, the antepenult, if accented, may have only the acute accent. Now, this doesn't mean that it has to be accented, but if it's going to be accented, it can only have the acute accent. So in a word like anthropos, you've got a short ultima, And if the antipenal, which is the third to the last syllable, is if it's accented, it may have only the acute accent. So anthropos. The on there would be your antipenal, and it can, if it's accented, it can only have the acute. In other words, you can't have a circumflex there. And of course, the rule about the circumflex only standing on the last two syllables of a word would, you know, pretty much give you the same information. Then part B, the penult, if accented, must have the circumflex if it itself is long, but the acute if it itself is short. So if you're going to accent the penult, then if it's long, it's going to have to be circumflex. If it's short, it's going to have to be acute. Under the condition that the ultima is short. And then C, the short ultima itself may have an acute accent, provided that a mark of punctuation or an enclitic and so forth immediately follows. If a word other than an enclitic follows immediately, the acute is changed to a grave. Note, however, that the interrogative tis or t always retains the acute, so we have an exception there. Now, this is just telling us then that if you're accenting a short ultima, the last syllable of the word is short, and if it's got the accent, then if the word that follows it is a word that has an accent itself, not an enclitic, then you'll change that thing from the acute over to a grave, so it'll slant the other way. And so, for example, we have huios there, and then by itself, it would just have the acute. But if huios is followed by another word that has an accent, namely fa'u here, then it's going to have the, it's going to slant back the other way and have a grave. Okay, so that'll take a little mystery out of what when that happens. Then if the ultima is long, the antipenal cannot have an accent. You know, you can almost think of it as that you've got more weight on the end of the word. You know, if that thing is long, you're spending a little bit more time, you know, putting stress there, and they don't like to put they like to put all the weight in one part of a word rather than spread it out, you know. So it's kind of where you get thinking that way, but in Hebrew the same way, you know, everything kind of slides down to the end of the word. And in Hebrew, vowel point changes and that type of thing. When you put stuff on the end of the word, the front of the word gets shorter, you know, and they'll shorten it down to shawa or something and then put all the heavy stuff on the end. And that's, in some respects, what you're seeing here, too. Same kind of an idea, anyway. So if the ultima is long, the antipenal cannot have an accent. The penal, if accented, may have only the acute, and that's regardless of whether it's long or short itself. And the long ultima itself may have either the circumflex or the acute. If it has the acute, this is changed to a grave according to the same rule above. Okay, we won't bother with the special rules of accent here. These get into some more refinements and exceptions and that type of thing with regard to certain declensions. But you may want to look through that on your own just as a reminder from time to time. Like I said, we're not putting any great deal of emphasis on this, so I don't want to take a lot of time with it. Then there's rules of accents for verbs on page 323. And there's one basic rule, and that is that the accent's recessive. If you kind of keep that in mind, that'll pretty much take care of most instances for you. In other words, it tries to get as far forward as it possibly can according to the rules. Which, if the ultima is short, it means it can be on the antipenult. So you get luomen, for example, epistuon, etc. Then if your ultima is long, of course, then you're going to have to slide it down at least one. So epistuo, for example, where you have an omega at the end, that's long, you can't get on the antipenult then. So that's your basic rule of thumb for those. Okay, going back to our chapter 2 here, punctuation. Probably don't need to say too much about that. We'll probably be encountering this a little bit more. So far we haven't dealt a whole lot with punctuation because we've seldom seen more than a part of a sentence at a time. When we get into translating, though, we'll see that this is the system that's used. And, of course, realize that this punctuation system wasn't part of the original text either. In the unsealed manuscripts, everything's run together and you don't have any punctuation. But in the UBS text and what, you know, the text that you're familiar with using, they'll use these punctuation marks, and these are the ones that are used. So a question mark is, first of all, you have what looks like a semicolon is used for a question mark. We have a dot that's above the line that's used for both the colon and the semicolon. And other than that, the commas and period and so forth are just like what we have now in English. And remember that there'll be lots of variations. One thing we'll be watching for as we're doing translating is looking for the variations in punctuation, and sometimes they can make a difference in meaning.
So Paul's epistles are signed 1-6.
Yeah, that's the way it was. Now I'm sure in there, you know, when a Greek person read that, you know, he was supplying punctuation in his mind, you know, from the grammatical devices. In other words, they were relying upon the grammatical devices involved in order to know where the breaks were and this type of thing. But that's why there's lots of debate sometimes as to whether this phrase belongs at the end of this clause or starts the next one. You know, I think there's one in Ephesians chapter 1, I think, in love having predestinated us, and some places put the in love at the end of the sentence above, and the other ones start, you know, verse 5 or something like that with in love. That's the reason for it. There's some debate about it. In some cases, there's debate about whether something's a question or a statement for the same reasons. Because in some instances, we have very definite question markers in Greek. Word order changes or certain question words. In other instances, you have to go by intonation pattern only. It's just a matter of, the same set of words could be either a statement or a question. In those instances, there's sometimes a lot of debate about that. Is this a question or is it a statement? So it's good to know where those problems are. We wish they weren't there. We wish that, you know, it was real clear, but we need to know where the ambiguities are so that we don't form a theological opinion that solely depends upon whether you take it as a question or a statement or something like that. Wouldn't want to be in a position like that. Okay, then the next few chapters are kind of unique to Getchus. Most of the other Greek textbooks don't go into this kind of linguistic analysis, and there's pluses and minuses to it. We're not going to spend a lot of time reviewing it here, but the pluses are that, especially for a student who's taking both Greek and Hebrew, for example, it does give you some insight into what languages are like and the way that they're put together. And that helps you generalize from one language to another a little bit better. And if you've got a real good grasp of English grammar, it helps you to generalize from the English to the Greek a little bit better to begin to see what the situation is and the fact that we're not really trying to take one word in one language and stick another word in another language on it. It's a lot more complicated than that. What we're really dealing with is two completely different linguistic systems, and we'll see some common things to them as far as the structure and how that structure is associated with meanings, but we need to shy away from the idea that one word in one language is going to be equivalent to one word in another language. And I think that's what the real benefit of this is, and then it helps you to generalize that to other languages. So he talks about linguistic structure here. He breaks down this into three systems: phonological system, which is your system of sounds, and we're not so much concerned with that. The grammatical system, which is divided into the morphological system, or the system of forms, and the syntactic system, or the system of arrangements of these forms, how you put those forms together to get meaning. And then the semantic systems, which relate the forms and arrangements of the forms with the meaning. So that's dealing with the meanings themselves of all of these forms. And under those categories, he talked about the phonological system for a short time here, and just talking about the fact that it represents the sounds of the spoken language. And then the grammatical system, and he introduces concepts like morpheme, which is the smallest portion of a word that has meaning. And that concept, you know, when we first went through this, you may have wondered, why is he bothering with this? But later on, when you start putting all kinds of endings on words and verbs and this type of thing, then you begin to see that concept is useful because it helps you see that a particular ending may have several morphemes in it, and they're associated with a particular meaning. A certain morpheme will be associated with first person, for example. Another morpheme will be associated with the aorist tense or something, you see. And you can begin to see those things and how they're put together to give meaning. So that's why this kind of concept was laid out in the first place. Then he gets into how to, you know, structure putting these things together. Words consisting of one or more morphemes. So you got smallest unit is morphemes, then the next unit up is words. Then you have construction, which is a group of words. Then you have a sentence, which is a construction that's marked complete by grammatical devices proper to the language in which it occurs. His definitions are a little bit different than what you may have learned in English, you know, sentences as complete thought, that type of thing. Because it's you get into trouble as how to define complete. And he gets into the problem here, you know. The doctor came quickly, the doctor came quickly to bandage the wound, you know. Each one of those sentences could be considered complete in a certain grammatical sense, but the thought gets more complete as you go here. So you wonder, you know, how are we defining that? So he's kind of leaning toward a definition that's based more on intonation patterns and grammatical devices that mark something as complete. When we speak, the way that a person knows we've stopped one sentence and started another sentence is primarily, well, first because of the completeness of having a subject and verb and that type of structure, but more than anything else, intonation pattern. That's what we know to put punctuation marks in, because we're picking up on the intonation patterns. And so we have a grammatical device called intonation that is transmitting information that we've got a complete thought there or a complete sentence. And so that's what he's looking toward. And then the semantic system, he makes quite a bit of discussion of this. Breaks it down into three subcategories. And of course, semantics is dealing with meanings, dealing with how words convey meaning. So he talks about this A here, the relationship between the forms of a language and the meanings which they express is conventional, meaning that a word means something because everybody else that speaks that language agrees that it means that thing. In other words, all words are is sounds that are to transmit meaning, and if we don't agree on the meaning of that within a given language, we're not going to get any meaning transmitted. And so it's by convention that we adopt the meaning of words. And of course, that can change over a period of time, even within a language. And of course, we've seen that in the English language, even in our own time. Then he talks about the relationship. Part B down here in the middle of page 17. The relationship between the forms of a language and the meanings which they express is seldom one-to-one. Okay? The idea of their meaning being that a given form, a given word with a given set of letters doesn't necessarily correspond to one and only one meaning. It's not a one-to-one relationship. A given form may have more than one meaning. And more than one meaning may be conveyed by a given form, a single form, and sometimes you may have the same meaning being conveyed by several forms, or at least approximately the same meaning. So you have things as synonyms and so forth, things like synonyms, and you have situations like this word bank, where the word, depending on its context, can mean quite different things. Works at the First National Bank, stretch out from the River Bank, banks at the Metropolitan Trust Company, and the fast car banks on sharp curves. You know, both as nouns and as verbs, the word has completely different meanings, but the form is the same. And we determine those different meanings by context. So that's true in just about every language, and something we need to keep aware of. I suppose in English is probably one of the worst culprits, because you've got so many words coming from so many different language roots in this language, so it's not so pure as Greek is, for example. Then, the third part here on page 19, the relationship between the forms of a language and the meanings which they express is rarely the same in any two languages. Now, that's real important to take note of. In other words, if you draw a relationship between a word in English, for example, and the meaning of that word in English, and a word in Greek and the meaning of that word in Greek, that relationship will not necessarily be the same in those two languages. In other words, if you were to take an English word and then put down all the range of meaning that English word has, and then put down a Greek word that's somewhat equivalent to it, and look at the range of meaning that Greek word has, that Greek word may have a slightly different range of meaning than the English word did. And that Greek word may be used in a different situation where you wouldn't use the English word. And this is where you get into these problems of a given Greek word translated a number of different ways in English. Now, lots of times that's due to the fact that the translator wants to get a little bit more variety in it and so forth for poetic beauty and that type of thing. And in that case, you can run into trouble. But we need to recognize also that a given word may not always be possible to translate the same way in English and really be honest to the Greek. Because we don't have a word in English that quite corresponds to the range of meaning that word has. That's why there is justification for translating some prepositions different ways in different situations, but we've got to be careful with that. I think they've gone way overboard with it. You can be a lot more precise than what they are, but nevertheless, a preposition used with a genitive case it may have a slightly different meaning than the same preposition used with a dative or with the accusative. And it's not so much that the preposition means something different, it's just that when you add the prepositional meaning to the case function meaning, and you combine those together, so in English we don't have a case form or anything to use. We have to just use a word to describe that total set of meaning. We may have to use a different word than we used when it wasn't used with that case, you see. So that's just something worthy of note. Now, I think that in general, there's been the English translator has gone far overboard on this. For example, you see the word logos here, and look at all the different ways it's translated. It doesn't mean that all those ways are necessarily justified. Although we need to be aware of the fact that we're dealing with a different language. What we really need to do is begin to think in Greek. And when we see the word logos, get the Greek spread of meaning of the word logos in our mind, not the English, not becoming to try to come over into English and try to spread it out in English. That's where lots of problems come. I think one of the biggest problems among students that have had enough Greek to be dangerous is they haven't learned to think in Greek. They've learned what Greek word should be used in here, in this instance, but they haven't learned it enough and been involved in it enough to have that kind of confidence to begin to think in the Greek language. That's the thing I really want to work toward this year in Greek too. I want you to be able to start thinking in Greek. In other words, your mental patterns over as you're reading are in the Greek mode, not in English. And you're seeing it in Greek and you're getting meaning out of the Greek, and then you're trying to convey that meaning in English, having gotten the meaning. Okay? Now, of course, he's got the top of the page there, the word I.E. Christ 7 times. You can see the theology coming through bold and clear there. All right? Any other questions on that? I don't want to belabor this part, but I think the more important aspects as far as Greek are concerned here in chapter 4, as far as this grammatical analysis is concerned. In chapter 4, we got used to some concepts. First of all, the difference between lexical meanings and structural meanings. Anybody, just off the top of your head, describe the difference between a lexical meaning and a structural meaning?
Lexical would be the meaning in the dictionary, structural would be how it's found in
use. Okay. Now, the lexical meaning is the meaning that you would find in the dictionary for the word. In other words, the basic raw meaning of the word. Whereas the structural meaning is the meanings that are conveyed by the grammatical devices in the sentence structure. In other words, structural meaning would be things like nominative case is a subject, accusative case is direct object. In other words, you're getting meaning out of certain grammatical devices that are used. So in other words, in a language, you could throw a bunch of words together, each of which had a lexical meaning. But if you threw them together in random, you see, and he gives this example of God loves a cheerful giver, you see, if you threw those words together in such a way, cheerful loves A, you've got all the words there and you have lexical meaning for all those, but the thing doesn't make any sense. In other words, you can get meaning out of each of those words, but you don't have any structural meaning because they are not following the grammatical devices of the language and they're not transmitting that. So we need to recognize both those kinds of meanings. And this is the main reason for taking a Greek grammar class. If it were only a matter of lexical meanings, all you'd need is a good lexicon. And you just look up the word and see, find out what it means. And that can get you a certain amount of information, but it can't transmit to you the proper grammatical information. And if you want to do grammatical analysis of a New Testament, for example, you've got to know something about the grammatical rules and the devices and how they're put together. You've got to know about things like the tense forms and the paradigms and the declensions and the genders and the, this and that and everything else. If you didn't, if it was just a matter of lexical meaning, if it's just a matter of doing a word study, you don't even need to know what a gender is. You're just going to do word studies. So we're here to be able to understand the grammar as well as the lexical meanings. And so it's important to make a distinction between that. And structural meaning is just as important as lexical meaning. You're not going to get any understanding of what's going on without structural meaning, especially when you're dealing with concepts, especially when you're dealing with covenant relationships and that type of thing that you're seeing in the New Testament, in instructions and admonitions. You need to know what those grammatical rules are to find out what the Scripture is telling you. It's not enough to just do a word study in every word that you see. Okay. Now, he starts comparing the kinds of grammatical devices. Now that we've introduced this concept of structural meaning and the meaning that's transmitted by the grammatical devices, he talks a bit about the kinds of grammatical devices we see in these languages. And here's what we find with the major differences between English and Greek. And that is that in English, word order is one of the most primary of all of the grammatical devices. The order in which you place the words will, to a large extent, determine what you're saying. And the man bites the dog versus the dog bites the man. You see, if you, all you have to do is reverse the order of those words, then you've got a completely different meaning. And this is, in Greek, is perhaps one of the hardest things for the new student to get used to, is that Greek does not rely upon word order. It relies upon different devices entirely. And among those devices are something called government and concord. And does anybody want to describe the difference between government and concord?
It's been too long.
Yeah, this one, I think. Anybody want to take a stab at it? Dan?
Listen, government determines where the words go, and concord is how they agree within the...
Right. Okay, that's the basic distinction. Government is a grammatical device that tells you how a word is functioning in a sentence. In other words, it tells you, for example, that the word is the subject of the sentence because it's in the nominative case. Or if you've got two nominatives, and you've got one of them with an article and the other one without, and so forth, it's going to identify which is the predicate nominative and which is the subject, that type of thing. In other words, it's telling you how a word functions within its sentence structure. Concord is telling you which words are going together, which words are linked together. An adjective with a certain ending is going to modify this particular noun, that type of thing. It's going to tell you how the words are linked together and agreeing with one another and functioning together as a unit. Concord is largely used to tie units words together into a kind of construction that functions together within the whole sentence structure. So you'll have concord tying this group of words together, and then you'll have a government telling you how this whole tied together group of words functions in the entire sentence structure. Okay, good. Government is largely, both government and concord, really, but especially government, is determined in Greek by inflectional forms. In other words, changes in the endings of words. Of course, these are broken down into the various declensions and nouns and this type of thing. Do I have the right time here?
Five minutes fast.
Oh, is that 5 minutes fast?
Yes.
Okay, I've got 10 minutes too, roughly. Okay, good. I'll have to get that corrected. Okay. So, as soon as the bell rings, somebody let me know here. Now, concord, of course, is also called agreement, and it says, section 31 here, certain words are required to have forms indicated by inflections which correspond to specified ways of forms of other words to which they are grammatically related. So they're grammatically related to other words, and this will happen when you have an adjective modifying a noun. It'll happen when a verb is going to have to agree in number and so forth with the noun that is the subject, etc. Okay, so that's just kind of a review of the basic structure of that. Is anybody else with any questions on that? If you've got that much of it in your mind, I think you've got all you really need as far as what we're trying to do. It's interesting there at the bottom, page 24, to see this phrase, God loves a cheerful giver, may be rendered by any of the following. There's 24 different possible combinations, 24 different ways to say that in Greek as far as word order is concerned. Now, you'll notice in all these 24 combinations, the same words are in the same cases and so forth. They just swap the word order around. So all you just have is the permutations of the word order here. And, of course, the articles, like ho theos, that's stuck to theos. That's not going to vary. But everything else varies. So what you've got, 1, 2, 3, 4 units, and it's the combinations and permutations of 4 units in every possible order. Okay.
And they all are correct.
Well, yes, they would all be technically correct, but they wouldn't all be as common to see. In other words, even though the Greek does have that tremendous variability capability, you're not likely to see some of these combinations as much as others. Remember that because of the fact that the word order varies, when they put something first, that's not the usual thing that they put first, or not the most common thing, it gets emphasis. And so they will use word order as a device to express emphasis. And so all of these 24 combinations have slightly different emphasis on different words in the sentence structure. And that's something to consider also as far as the meaning. So there's a slightly, they do mean slightly different, just in terms of emphasis, but not in terms of the basic grammatical structure there that's involved. Okay. Then chapter 5, the parts of speech, we begin to start applying this, and he introduced a couple more distinctions his inflectional or paradigmatic definitions and his distributional or syntactic definition of words. In other words, what we're trying to do is assign categories to different words in the language. Just like in English, we have nouns and we have verbs and we have adjectives and we have adverbs and prepositions and conjunctions and so forth. The same kinds of things are going to be seen in Greek. And the question is, how do you define what a noun is? How do you define what a verb is and so forth? And there are some rather simple definitions that are generally okay as long as you're dealing with one particular language only. Within a given language, you may be able to give a more restrictive definition of what you mean by something. But when you start to apply this to lots of languages, then you're trying to look for a little bit more general base for definition, and that's really what he's doing here. And so he's saying that we can define these parts of speech in terms of inflectional or paradigmatic definitions, and this lends itself very well to Greek because Greek is loaded with paradigms. And so you can usually tell what a word is by what kind of a paradigm it fits into. And that's what he's saying. And then there's the distributional or syntactic definition, and that is basically, remember these little frames that he'd make, you know, where he leaves the blank in there, he gives a sentence, leaves a blank, and it says a noun is a word that can fit into this blank. That kind of a definition. Those are kind of difficult definitions. It's almost like defining it from the negative side, you know. In actual practice, this would probably be real difficult to maintain rigorously, but he's trying to convey a concept, and I think as far as the concept goes, we're all right. Well, we'll stop here, and tomorrow we'll continue from chapter 5 here as far as our review is concerned. And as you go through and look at this yourself, you know, if you run into problems that you never did get real well the first time or they're real fuzzy, you know, be sure and raise your hand and we'll take some more time to talk about it. And you might be taking a look at your workbook exercises. If you run into an area that you're rusty on, go back to your workbook and erase the answers out of it and do it again, you know, or something, just to get the review. We'll do the best we can here. Okay, thank you. Yes, I think 701, 702, 702, so and Wednesday would be 701. That's where I'll be anyway. If we're all wrong, we'll have to move. Bless you, George. How are you, brother? Love you, too. God bless you.
Hope this is a Greek Hebrew orientation with Mike Early.
I hope so, this next class. This was Greek 1, this last one, so.
Never get that far.
You never know, brother.
Not that good in English.
You never know.
I know that they're not named students in English.
Yeah.
Right
now,
I don't know if it's
going
to make any difference
for
the semester or not, but you're listed as being in the
room. Is that right? Oh, no. For the room number?
And I didn't even take a look in here because I've never seen Greek down here.
Oh, yeah.
It was listed as L-503.
Oh, you're kidding.
I think, and so I went to the operations
to ask
where
L-503
was.
Oh, no. They should. Right. Let's see, mine was
504.
They have
it right on another one, I'm not sure.
Oh, they may have changed it. Let's see, mine's got 504, I think.
Yeah,
okay. It's definitely 504. I'm going to see the possibility of moving to 506A, depending on our grad student schedule, because I'd like to have the tables, and you know, once we start spreading books out.
I'd like to be able to get books out to at least this review, so that I can have a refreshing.
Right.
No, it's
Is it really?
Well,